Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. A damning report from the University of Colorado Boulder charges that its philosophy department has maintained a boorish culture that is hostile to women and more akin to a locker room than lecture hall. The Colorado report follows the surprising downfall of a star in the philosophy field, Colin McGinn, who left his tenured post at University of Miami last summer after allegations of sexual harassment brought by a graduate student. What is being called the Boulder sex scandal has stirred up a storm in academic circles. Slate's education columnist Rebecca Schumann is with us for more on the report and whether it reflects the field of philosophy at large. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
So great to be here.
So tell us about this report. What kind of behavior was discovered at the University of Colorado Boulder?
Well, it's very interesting because even though the report is 15 pages long and extraordinarily confident in its findings, it doesn't include any specific incidents because to do so would reveal the identity of the participants, which would be against the law. And so many detractors of the report have been angry that it doesn't include specific incidents, but the reason why it doesn't is because it would be both very crushing to the people involved to do so, who are innocent until presumed guilty and deserve to be protected if they're victims, and also quite illegal.
Okay, so what about some of these sort of examples of like bro culture?
Yes, so what they did manage to convey, and everyone there knows exactly who they're talking about, I'm sure, is that the culture of the department was such that all of its main events were just soaked in alcohol, and that it was a very common activity for faculty and graduate students to go off-site to bars at night and just get extraordinarily drunk, just absolutely plastered. And then once the alcohol flowed, obviously inhibitions would go down, and certain faculty members who possibly are from a different generation when it was considered more socially acceptable to treat women a certain way would say and do things that would be more at home on an episode of Mad Men than, you know, in a 2014 philosophy department.
Ouch. Who filed this report and how did it come out?
This is the interesting part. The department commissioned it itself. The members of the department have closed ranks completely. They won't talk to anybody but their other friends in philosophy. And so what some philosophy blogs have managed to squeeze out of the department is that the majority of the members of the department were very upset about the actions and behaviors of a minority. And so because the university wasn't taking action on the 15 complaints that had been filed in the last 7 years, they commissioned an outside report, the department did, from the American Philosophical Association's Committee for the Status of Women. And so three members from this committee came to Boulder and did a site visit, and they interviewed everybody, students, staff, faculty, males and females together, males and females separately, administration, undergrads, grad students. They did extensive interviews. And from those interviews, they found that there is a constant feeling of female unfriendliness, unfriendliness to LGBT and other individuals who are members of unrepresented groups. And I say unrepresented groups in philosophy because it is the whitest male's discipline in all of the humanities. And it was just a sort of general environment where many female members were afraid to come to work at all, worked from home, didn't go to events. And if they did complain to the university, those complaints were filed but not followed up on. And so they commissioned this report because they wanted an official record so that perhaps the administration would take action. But the administration obviously was going to see the report too, and it was so terrible. My guess is that they thought, oh, we better get out in front of this and throw this department under the metaphysical motor coach as quickly as possible.
Well, the administration has reacted. I read in the Chronicle of Higher Ed's headline was, Boulder takes bold steps to right a hostile climate in philosophy. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the faculty chair was removed. Mm-hmm. Grad student admission into the department has been suspended. Now, what do you think of the university's response?
I think that on paper, it's quite a good one, but I would also wonder why one department with 15 complaints hadn't resulted in changes like that many years sooner.
Hmm. Do you think this is an isolated problem within a culture of one university, or is
No.
it? Tell me more.
Well, the academic disciplines in general have been like this since time immemorial and have only recently begun to be a more welcoming environment for women, LGBT individuals, and people of color since the 1980s, when policies changed at universities to punish or at least have some sort of acknowledgement of sexual and racial harassment and discrimination. Affirmative action started making sure that departments got a little bit more diversity. And so in many other departments, especially across the humanities in the literary disciplines, you have a much more diverse array of people and thus a larger diversity of opinion. And so these problems are not quite as widespread. Somehow philosophy has managed to remain a very white and very male-dominated discipline. It actually has by far the worst diversity in the humanities and also the worst diversity among most of the sciences. Even things like engineering, computer science, biochemistry, things that are considered to be very male disciplines. And so when almost all of the people in a department are males of a certain kind and almost all the people that you read are also these sort of long dead white males, it creates an environment of homogeneity that almost makes it seem like, you know, women and LGBT individuals and people of color aren't even there, not even in the conversation. Mm. And this is not, I didn't come up with this. This is philosophers, especially feminist philosophers, have written extensively. Sally Hershberger, for example, Jenny Saul, both of these very high-ranking women philosophers have written about this culture extensively. Mm. And so unfortunately, it is a problem that spans across universities. I can't really speak to the UK and other English-speaking philosophy departments in other countries, but I know personally many individuals who have had inappropriate sexual behavior in philosophy departments happen to them.
Well, unfortunately, it reinforces this idea that philosophy departments are sort of, you know, echo chambers, just talking one to another. But there are people who've been public about this. There's a blog that's been running since 2010 called What Is It Like to Be a Woman in Philosophy? Now, this features anonymous posts from female philosophy students and faculty. So this report first, and then the response to what happened in Colorado. Do you think it does reflect a larger awareness or even sense of activism about this?
Well, yes and no. The response was very mixed. Among the feminist philosophy community and just, you know, philosophers who have their brains on right in general, there was outrage and also this resignation of there are so many Colorados out there and what is this report's release going to do? It might cause departments in the future just to close ranks and never ask for an outside audit again. And then on the other hand, there's this enormous uproar in philosophy of how dare they release the report. There's no specifics in it, so everybody could be lying. It's an exaggeration. It was a few bad apples. The rest of these innocent people are going to be damaged. The department's reputation is ruined. A lot of people came to the defense of the department immediately, and the members of the department reacted to the release of the report to the public as if it was the worst thing that had ever happened to them and as if they were victims of a witch hunt.
Rebecca Schumann, always wonderful to talk with you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Rebecca Schumann, education columnist at Slate, where she wrote about a philosophy department scandal at the University of Colorado Boulder following a report showing abject sexism. There is a link to read her column. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. And to all of our listeners who dabbled in college philosophy, do you think the discipline has an inherent problem with sexism? Did you experience breaches of conduct whilst studying Plato or Descartes? Let us know on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. The Jamaican team came in last in the two-men bobsled events in Sochi, but true to the spirit of the 1994 film Cool Runnings, Jamaican fans sent the team off with a song written to sync with the twists and turns of the 1,500-meter track.
To the left, it's bobsled time. On this freezing night, watch Jamaica slide by.
To the right,
it's bobsled time.
The gold for the two-man bobsled went to Russia. U.S. took the bronze, the first two-man bobsledding medal for the U.S. in 62 years, which may have something to do with a new high-tech bobsled designed by BMW. Yes, that BMW, the precision luxury German automaker. Michael Scully is creative director at BMW Designworks USA and was an integral part of building a better bobsled. He's also a New Hampshire native who got his winter sport legs on this state's icy mountains. We got to talk with him just before he left for Sochi to see how his rig rides, and I asked him what he was doing before he started working on bobsleds.
I guess over the years, maybe two notable projects that have sort of found the light of day are in 2002, I worked on a Formula BMW race car, which was a carbon fiber monocoque chassis development series car. And then in 2004, I worked on a BMW H2R, which was a hydrogen-powered world speed record car. And we set 9 world speed records with that car.
Well, we've all driven cars. I'm wondering what kind of research goes into designing a bobsled. Did you have to pilot one yourself?
Well, my research was, I would say, firsthand. I actually flew out to the team trials in Lake Placid back in 2011. And, you know, I literally set foot on the ground out by opening the door of my rental car, shook maybe one or two hands, and was put straight into the bobsled at the top of the run. And luckily I didn't have the requirement to drive it. I was a passenger, and Steve Holcomb was driving, and Kurt Tomaszewicz was right behind me. They were both gold medal winning athletes, and so I knew I was in good hands, but I have to say that I thought I was somewhat prepared for that because I had this experience with alpine sports in the past, and you know, I raced cars extensively, so I maybe a little bit of hubris on my side going in, and that was quickly destroyed. It is the most profoundly violent, chaotic, brutal experience I've had, and it actually did inform the design process, and there were a lot of takeaways for me.
Like what? What did you think? You know, when you were going along on this ride, you thought, "Oh, I can make this go even faster."
Well, that sort of level of chaos again. I think it's something if you can help quell that a little bit. You know, just to allow the pilot to focus, or for example, the brakeman, who's the athlete in the back of the sled, for them to brace themselves even a little bit more effectively. I mean, I was clamoring all over the place for anything and everything to hang on to or put my head. And I mean, it was just it really was a nightmare in a way. And I saw that again as an opportunity to try to build in a little bit more functionality on the inside of the sled, and so we've placed a large emphasis on that.
What did the previous bobsled model look like? Very similar?
I would say by comparison, our sled is noticeably smaller. That's probably the first takeaway that somebody would have looking at it. And you know, the real motivation behind that was sort of a double-edged reason. One was aerodynamic, trying to reduce the frontal area, which is really the silhouette that would be cast on a wall if you were to put a spotlight directly in front of the sled. That has a large impact on the aerodynamic properties. But also embracing the physics, the reality of the physics of a bobsled run, which is that this sled is almost never going straight, and it's almost constantly transitioning between corners or in a corner or descending a corner or ascending a corner. And all these movements are things which potentially can slow it down.
In your clamoring around, looking for something to hold on to, I'm wondering what the others were doing. What does one do when inside of a bobsled, just holding on for dear life and praying?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the athletes that do it for real, they hold a very precise position of their body because the profile of, say, for example, the athletes at the back of the sled, that has a huge impact on the aerodynamic performance of the sled. So it's not just the shape of the exterior of the sled that impacts the aerodynamics. It's how the athletes also are involved. And so the contour of their back is something that's important to keep in a certain position. And so they will be sort of bracing themselves pretty much as low as they possibly can get And, you know, that's obviously not a fun position to experience 5 G's of force at, but that is what they do. And I think, you know, my experience on the track really just gave me an appreciation for that level of force. And it is an extreme sport in a very real way.
Well, we're getting a wild ride inside a bobsled with Michael Scully. He's creative director at BMW Designworks USA, and he designed the two-man bobsled for the U.S. Olympic team. Speaking of that force, top speeds reaching 100 miles an hour. I'm reading a lot of different numbers. How fast do they go?
Yeah, I think, you know, for example, on the Sochi track, which is a very technical track, top speed is not a incredible number. It's somewhere between 75 and 85 miles an hour is probably realistic. That's still extremely fast on a gravity propelled object. And, you know, it, every efficiency at that point is necessary. And so that's really what this project has emphasized is, you know, there is no sort of magic bean that just makes the sled go faster. It's kind of this culmination of hundreds and hundreds of little elements that add up into little nuanced changes that potentially eke out, you know, a little bit of time here, a little bit of time there, and it may add up into a hundredth of a second or a tenth of a second or something like that. But it is a sport of hundredths of a second. So that's sort of the minutia that we try to work in.
Well, with that kind of specifics, I'm wondering, there must be a lot of secrecy around the design. I mean, if any little tweak can get an advantage of even a hundredth of a second.
Yeah, I mean, you know, working in the automotive sector, that's that level of confidentiality is something that we're familiar with. And that's important, I think, because, you know, this project in particular has been very much a collaboration with the U.S. bobsled team. And they have lifetimes of experience that they've brought to the table and really informed our process with as well. And so, you know, if those things all of a sudden were to get exposed unnecessarily, then, you know, it sort of sacrifices their incredible life's work. And that's something we take very seriously, too.
And then do you work with the drivers of the bobsleds? You know, what is your relationship with the people who are actually going to be driving these sleds like?
Yeah, absolutely. Steve Holcomb has been incredibly instrumental in the development of the sled. In particular, I would point to the steering system. The steering system is what I like to think of as sort of the central nervous system of the sled, and that really is what connects the pilot to the sled and then also to the track. And so that's the conduit through which all these feedbacks and inputs need to flow. And that's an absolutely critical, very nuanced mechanism that we placed a huge emphasis on. And Steve, you know, actually had a degenerative eye condition for much of his career. And so he developed almost the sixth sense, and he has the ability to feel things that you at first wouldn't even believe. It took me a little while to come to grips with the level of subtlety that he was able to sense. So in that sense, he was just an incredible asset as far as developing the steering system. We've also had athletes here at the studio, and we actually scan them in position in the sled so that any of our aerodynamic simulations would be truly accurate to the position or the shape and contour of the athletes, their backs, their helmets, but also the physiology where their legs want to be, where their arms want to be, and that allowed us to kind of position the rest of the components of the sled fairly strategically.
Well, BMW Designworks is located in California. You are originally from New Hampshire. I wonder, as a former snowboarder, as somebody who has experienced winter, do you think you brought a different perspective than another designer might have?
For this project in particular, you know, my snowboard racing days certainly was the real kind of formative stage for me. Of understanding the rhythm of a course and how you approach that, or how you sacrifice certain corners so that other corners, which are more important, can be done better. Mm-hmm. And that's very much, there is a lot of crossover with bobsledding that way. And so, you know, it's a life experience that hopefully informed the project, but it's also been an incredible learning experience for me, and I really had just absolutely loved the program.
Hats off from afar to Michael Scully, New Hampshire native and creative director at BMW Design Works USA, which designed and built the two-man bobsled. You can take a look at his design in action and watch the wonderfully camp animation of the Jamaican bobsled song written for the Sochi course. All that is at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are so many great ideas being passed around word of mouth. We'll be back with more next week on NHPR and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.